Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. We're closing our 2021 season here on the wake-up call with three stories from earlier this year. Later in this hour, you'll hear portions of our interview with University of Virginia professors Andrea Press and Fiona Greenland as they discuss the cultural significance of 50th anniversaries. Also, later in the program, we'll take another listen to our interview with University of Virginia Assistant Dean and Assistant Professor Shipla Dave about the role that Muppets have played in reflecting modern culture. But first, from March, Sunday morning wake-up call host Rick Moore talked with University of Virginia Magazine journalist Ed Miller and speaker and author Ron Culbertson about the history of the University of Virginia Pep Band. Here's Rick Moore.
Today we're going to talk about the history and tales of UVA's Pep Band. Our guest today, we have Ed Miller with us. He's the associate editor at Virginia Magazine. He's also the author of a recent article called Pep Band, The Pep Band's 30 Years of Scrambling on the Edge. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
We also have Ron Culbertson. Ron is a speaker, author, and humorist. Ron was also a member of the Pep Band from 79 to 83 on the writing committee, as well as a field conductor in 1982. Ron, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I was a big fan of the Pep Band. I went to school at UVA from 82 to 89 and then remained in Charlottesville and attended numerous football games throughout the demise of the Pep Band, and was always a supporter found it highly entertaining. So I was very excited and entertained by the article, Ed. I found that quite enjoyable. And Ron, a big supporter of the band in general. But I want to start, not everybody knows UVA's Pep Band. If you went to the school, hopefully so during that time period. But certainly there are listeners today who are unfamiliar, whether it's because you went to a different school, you have no idea what a pep band, scramble band is. Ron, can you take on that task for us?
Sure. So a scramble band, from our perspective, was based on the Ivy League schools where they didn't have traditional marching bands. Instead, they had scramble bands, which were basically joke bands. We did jokes, we did a formation, and we did music. That was the simple formula. 8 to 10 of those per game, where you would tell a joke, form a picture on the field, and then play a piece of music that went with it. So, for instance, one of the classic jokes that was used several times over the years was the announcer would come on the loudspeaker, and the announcer, by the way, was one of our band members who was up in the press box. We would write the script, and he would deliver it, and he would say something like, "Would the owner of $10,000 in small, unmarked, non-sequential bills wrapped in rubber bands please report to the ticket office? We have your rubber bands." and then we would form something like a dollar sign on the field, and we might play, you know, the song Money from Pink Floyd. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we would do, and we'd have 8 to 10 of those per show, often targeting either the opposing team, current events, or the terrible food in the cafeteria, which was a common topic as well.
So you were a member of the band. Ed, what was your personal connection that made you want to write this article about the history of UVA's Pep Band?
Well, in a previous life, I was a sports writer for many years and covered UVA now and then, UVA football in particular. And so I was familiar with the Pep Band, and in fact, was there for their last show, which came in 2002, and which we discuss in the article. So we were looking at this issue, and it was a subject I think they wanted to tackle for a while. And my editor said, I think you're the guy to do it, because I had some familiarity with it. We wanted to kind of keep it light and fun, and in particular in this issue with everything that's been going on in the world and with the COVID and some of our other issues, you know, had dealt with that. And so we thought we'll just try to give people a little bit of a break and, you know, try to do something fun. So I had seen the Pep Band perform a couple times, wrote a couple stories when I worked down in Norfolk at the Virginian Pilot. Newspaper about the Pep Band and some of the controversy that surrounded it in its, you know, in its later years.
So tell me the challenges of putting this article together.
The biggest challenge was I think I had about 40 or maybe more pages of notes just from talking to as many people as I could from throughout the Pep Band's 30-year history. So that included people from the early the mid-1970s all the way up through 2002 and 2003, and even some people who were in another iteration of what was called the Pep Band back in the 60s, although it wasn't the same organization. It wasn't the same type of band. It was a more traditional band. So I would say the biggest challenge was just sifting through all that material, finding the best stuff, and then trying to tell it in a way that people could follow chronologically, but also, you know, that it was entertaining and wasn't dry. So it was a lot of fun to write. I mean, people like Ron, who I talked to, had great stories, and there was this real spirit of camaraderie among all the Pep Band members from different generations, if you will. And there was a great sense of institutional knowledge. I mean, people that were in the band in the early 2000s knew some of the lore from 25 or 30 years before that. So there was a real sense of pride in the band, and I wanted to try to you know, bring that out in the story if I could. So it was a lot of fun to write, and gotten some pretty good reaction so far.
Now, Ron, you were a member as well as being a field conductor. Were you ever up in the press box doing the pieces up there?
What we did, the way this worked was that an individual got elected, basically, to be the announcer, because that was a pretty prestigious job. The field conductor job was basically your job was to run the show committee, which was charged with writing the jokes, putting together the formations, and picking the music. So as pay for that, they let you go out and direct the band on the field. Even though the guy that did it with me, we partnered one year. We were co-field conductors. We had no experience whatsoever in conducting, but you didn't really have to. But I only went up in the press box a couple of times to do voices. I was the voice of Mr. Rogers for a skit we did one time, and I think I did somebody else, but I can't for the life of me remember what it was. But otherwise, that job went to the person who actually auditioned and was elected to be the announcer for the year. And generally, you might have the same person for a couple of years if they were good at it, because you wanted to have that continuity.
I asked because I was wondering if you could do the official name of the band for folks.
Oh, sure. So there was always some sort of lead-in at the beginning of this. At the beginning of we also did the pregame and then the halftime. So we came in on the field twice, and the pregame was really, we might make one joke, but it is generally just the national anthem and then the Cavalier song. But there was always some sort of lead in that allowed us to then say it's the award-winning University of Virginia Fighting Cavalier Indoor Outdoor Precision Marching Pep Band and Chowder Society Review Unlimited. That was the full name.
Why such a long name? And what is Chowder Society Review?
Now, you know, it's so funny you ask that, because I was going through my notes earlier today and I thought, I bet he's going to ask what a Chowder Society is. And I have no idea, although I looked it up and there's a couple of different definitions online about what it is. But it's basically I think it had some ties to political groups back a long, long time ago. But I saw one definition that said it was a group of people who controlled themselves and were not controlled by outside regulations. And I said, well, that's the definition I'm going to go with, because that fits the pep band to a T. But I'll tell you why the long name. I think it was just that's the personality of the band. We did not. I saw a bumper sticker one time that said, I march to a different accordion. And I think that's exactly what the pep band was. And at the beginning of the document where Steve Mershon presented all of this to the administration and to the athletic department, there was a quote at the beginning of his long description of what this should be about. And it was a quote from the Stanford band, who were also a scramble band. It was a quote from their handbook that said, it was just a quote from someone else that said, your band was everything a university band shouldn't be, and we loved it. And I think that's kind of what the personality of the band was. It was like if somebody zigged, we zagged. And the idea was to do that so that we were different and unique, but also clever and funny. So that was kind of the motivation of it all.
So, Ed, when you're putting this together, you've got all this material. Can you give us a little bit of history? How did the band come about? Ron mentioned a name, but who and when and why did this all start? Because it doesn't go back to the 1890s.
Right. First of all, I'm really impressed with Ron's ability to recite that name by memory. That's impressive, because that's a long name.
We did it a lot.
yeah. And I had forgotten that until I was doing the story. I said, oh, yeah, they do have a formal name. And it was just a pep band. But it all started in the early 70s. A guy named Steve Mershon was kind of the point man on getting the band together, and there were a couple other people that were involved as well. He was doing some graduate work at UVA, and he had been in the previous iteration of the pep band in the 60s, which was really the music department had kind of fallen on hard times. To go way, way back, there was a band dating from about in the mid-1930s that played at football games, and they were making a trip up to Yale for a game in the early 40s. The band bus caught fire, and basically the uniforms and a lot of the instruments were lost. So the band kind of just limped on for another 15 years or so. In the late 50s, early 60s, there wasn't much of a band presence at Virginia at all. There were a lot of high school bands would play at the football games. And really, it was kind of keeping with the way a lot of Virginia students preferred it. They didn't want to be regarded as a state U. They felt like they were, a little different. Didn't want a traditional regimented sort of militaristic marching band like a lot of schools have. So, but Steve said he had read an article sometime in the late 60s, early 70s about it. Might have been the Columbia University band or one of the Ivy League scramble bands in the New York Times. And he thought it would be a great fit at UVA, which, kind of did regard it, and I think still regards itself as kind of a public Ivy League school. And, a good fit with the culture at Virginia. So it took them a good year or so of planning. And as Ron mentioned, they put together a proposal. They got official approval from the athletic department, from the Board of Visitors. And they debuted in 1974 against William and Mary at Scott Stadium. And of course, in those days, Virginia football was, you know, honestly not very good. A lot of people would leave at halftime and not come back. So that was a way of sort of holding people's interest at halftime of these for this hapless football team. So they started in 74 and got it off the ground with some shows. And as Steve had said, his first one of his major intentions was to be funny without being offensive. Some of the Ivy League bands, you know, were a lot edgier, to be honest, than Virginia was. But it was a different kind of, different scale, if you will. Ivy League football, you know, you might play in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people in those days. At Virginia, even when they weren't very good, it was just a lot more went into it. They were in the ACC. So he wanted to be funny without being offensive, but they sort of got away from that in subsequent years and, began offending people, which is really what a lot of people remember the Pep Band for.
Ron, do you want to talk about a couple as I list them? And hopefully you're up to, because I'm sure they're on the wall of fame / shame somewhere. Can you do the talk about the UVA Rutgers game in the fall of 1980 and the piece on the Rutgers marching band?
And I think, I don't remember any particular controversy coming from that, because I was there that year and I don't remember any fallout.
But I think and I guess I didn't phrase that well in terms of that's not controversial as well as that may not be, but it can certainly be construed as offensive.
Yeah. So, and let me put a filter on this for anybody that's listening, because I think we need to understand that it was a different era. And there was different sensibilities and there were different filters with which people viewed humor and comedy. And things are very different today. But you know, as we always targeted our opposing team when we were at home, and that's just what we did. But we were playing Rutgers, and the announcer came on and said, "We regret to inform you that the Rutgers University Marching Scarlet Knights could not be here this afternoon. We understood that complications arose on their way to Charlottesville. Upon crossing the Jersey state line, half the band applied for political asylum, and the other half died from overexposure to clean air." And so that was the joke. I mean, because that was the stereotypical New Jersey joke for many, many years, you know, probably not 100% accurate, but that was the stereotype.
Oh, my. And then, of course, jokes against Virginia Tech, the primary rival, were quite the scene, correct?
Yes. That was our pinnacle game every year, as it is today. I mean, you know, the team works towards that game as the highlight of every year, and we work towards it every year as the highlight of our show. So some of the best jokes that we wrote throughout the year would get filed away in the Tech show because we wanted to save some of the better ones for that. And I think, again, it was about trying to be clever and funny. And as Steve Mershon said, if we inadvertently offended, that was not the goal. The goal was to be funny. And if in the process we inadvertently offended, we certainly, would take responsibility for that. But that was not the target.
You've been listening to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call host Rick Moore's conversation with UVA Magazine journalist Ed Miller and speaker and author Ron Culbertson about the history of the University of Virginia Pep Band. On this, our season finale, we're taking a look back at three of our shows from 2021. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. After the break, University of Virginia Department of Media Studies Professor Andrea Press and UVA Department of Sociology Professor Fiona Greenland join us to talk about the cultural significance of 50th anniversaries. Please stay with us. Later in the hour, University of Virginia Professor Shipla Dave will be joining us to talk about the Muppets in popular culture. But first, from September, UVA Department of Media Studies Professor Angia Press and UVA Department of Sociology Professor Fiona Greenland joined us to talk about the cultural significance of 50th anniversaries. Once again, your host, Rick Moore.
Today we're going to take on an interesting topic. We're going to talk about some of the 50th anniversaries throughout U.S. culture being discussed and celebrated this year in 2021. We brought along two guests today, Professor Andrea Press. She's a UVA professor of media studies and sociology at the University of Virginia. Also served as executive director of Virginia Film Festival. Prior career faculty positions include departments as diverse as communications, sociology, writing studies, social psychology, film, and women's studies. We have Fiona Greenland. She's a UVA assistant professor of sociology. She studies the construction of cultural heritage and the uses of antiquities in contemporary politics and markets. Ladies, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick, for having us. Great to be here.
Well, I have been wanting to do something similar to this show for a while. And you regularly see or hear on the news, on the radio, wherever you get your information from about today, back in time, this happened X number of years ago. And if you listen to NPR, their NPR is 50 years old today or this year. So they are doing their own version of this. And it triggered me to go find folks to come on and do Sunday morning wake-up calls version of this program. So, Professor Press, first I want to know what makes an event or a film or a product, an album culturally memorable or even iconic in the first place?
Well, you know, in media studies, we have a concept that we call a media event. And I think in the modern era, and I'm thinking really throughout the 20th century and probably before, if you point to iconic events like the death of President John F. Kennedy or the first American space or 9/11, what immediately comes to mind is media coverage of these events and how that galvanized the population. They were media events. The death of Princess Diana and the television coverage of her funeral and the mourning around her. So I would say in the modern era, a memorable event is a media event, but Professor Greenland studies the pre-modern era. She may have different ideas about what makes a cultural event memorable.
Yeah, and I would agree with the focus on media coverage as an important factor in what makes something memorable, because I think that speaks to a collective recognition of a thing or an event, a film, for example, as memorable. And I would add a couple more things. A shared experience. We could think about feelings, maybe like an exciting encounter for the very first time with a particular album or artist, going to a show. And then I would also add cohort take up. So that's an idea we use in sociology to think about how a birth cohort or years of people born in and around the same period of time, recognizing together that they've just been through something unique and distinctive. And I guess a final thought on that is a lot of folks who study iconic milestones and long-term memories of things have suggested that young cohorts or young generations are the most active in creating those iconic milestones. And so there must be something, too, about how when you're a young adult, you're maybe more likely to change your worldview or reflect back on something as having been formative and worth remembering.
Whether we have experienced this together as a cohort group or whether it is because multiple cohort groups have witnessed it through media coverage, why do we feel the need to witness it over and over again? Because isn't that what's happening when we note it on the calendar and say, Jim Morrison died. This is the death of Jim Morrison happened in 1971. Jim Morrison from the band The Doors. And so for many people or many media organizations, they will say, you know, when, and I don't have the date in front of me, September 9th, 1971, Jim Morrison passed. And that happens every year. What purpose is there to that in a sociological manner?
It can be in part, I think, that we structure our social lives through the shared reflection on something traumatic in the case of the passing of Jim Morrison. There are also, of course, positive memories or milestones, anniversaries that we also reflect on. And I think that for me, I like to study the ways in which we come to understand or think we've had a direct experience, even in cases where we weren't there or were remote, because in learning from and recognizing other people's experiences, their versions of that milestone, we bond with them. So for sociologists, there's something very important about that group experience and the feeling of being part of something, the carrier group of a memory or milestone that stitches us together with other people.
And Professor Press, just to go back to the Jim Morrison example, in media studies, in some ways it seems, and not to belittle the what some people would say is the importance of Jim Morrison in music, but in some ways it often seems that material is filler to me. How this day is Penguin Day. This day is this day is birthday card day. And so today we're honoring or noting Jim Morrison passed on this day. It just happened to this year to be 50 years ago. Your thoughts on that in a media studies kind of way?
Well, yeah, I think you are putting your finger on one of the primary characteristics of the current media environment, that we are bombarded with hours and hours of ubiquitous media coverage. We never get to have silence on our television screens, our radios, on YouTube. So there is sort of a grasping for material that isn't always perhaps the most important material. If every day we have 24 hours to fill on a radio station, that is a lot of work to search for topics to fill the 24 hours. And I know that I'm a true crime enthusiast, and I have just discovered a new podcast that tells me a crime that was committed for every day of the year. It's called Cup of Coffee with Crime. Start your morning knowing about the anniversary of whatever crime was committed today. And it's kind of a watering down, I think, of what is interesting about crime and the prosecution of criminals, because there are too many podcasts and too much fillers needed.
Sunday morning wake-up call talking about anniversaries through U.S. culture. This year, 50th anniversaries throughout U.S. culture. Our guest, Professor Fiona Greenland, UVA's Department of Sociology, and Professor Andrea Press, Sociology Department, as well as a professor in the Media Studies. So let's list a few. Let's pick a genre and list a few and talk about their importance, if they have any, 50 years later, because they're noted. So let's do TV first, if you're both okay with that. Some of the ones that I that I found, 1971, so 50 years later, 50th anniversaries of Masterpiece Theater, Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, Soul Train, The Electric Company, and Norman Lear's All in the Family. So let's talk about a couple of these. Who wants to take on Masterpiece Theater and The Electric Company? Because weren't both of those on PBS?
They were. And I think you're right to point out that their anniversaries could be celebrated as a move on American television towards the position that it now holds. Media scholars used to belittle television studies, and we really didn't teach television in college classrooms. Scholars didn't write about television very much 50 years ago. But now we actually look to television productions for some of the highest production values of our culture. What we call quality television has surpassed popular filmmaking in many ways as the way some of the most important cultural productions come about. And I would say one way to look at the history of current quality television might be to look at 1971's production of Masterpiece Theater, which was a great media event at the time. All of a sudden, you could learn something from watching television. I remember Upstairs, Downstairs was a very popular early show on Masterpiece Theater, and it taught us about the British class system, what the difference between the upper class and the working class were. Americans didn't often know much about that history. and Electric Company was the beginning of educational television for children. Sesame Street, Electric Company, all of a sudden, Saturday morning TV wasn't a wasteland. It might be looked at as a place where children learn math, they learned how to read, they learned the alphabet, and it started to be seen as with a lot of potential. Oh, maybe we could educate children with this black box that sits in most American living rooms. And it was the beginning of a change in attitudes toward television programming, which I would say today our attitudes have really come 100%. And most media departments have one or more scholars specializing in television studies.
I would love to jump in and add to Andrea's observations about the power of television and it being taken more and more seriously as this social medium. Rick, you mentioned Norman Lear and All in the Family, and we've got to spend a minute talking about that. This show debuted in 1971. Norman Lear, up-and-coming writer, had some successful projects. This show was always bound to stir up controversy because in the Norman Lear fashion, he was taking on vital social issues of the day concerning race, concerning gender relations, concerning class and culture and politics. It's all there. And he did it in front of a live studio audience. So it's hard to imagine right now, I think, given the diversity of television offerings, scripted shows that Andrea touched on, it's hard to imagine how that show would have upended things or kind of shaken the genre of television. But it did, and not everybody liked it, found the characters problematic, controversial, but it then went on, right? It was like a slow burn success. We can look back on it now as a true cultural milestone for changing the way television was done and sort of what television was capable of doing. Yeah, I would leave it at that with All in the Family.
How about a program like Soul Train? I mean, now we're talking about different ethnicities.
They are. And I think, unfortunately, in the 1960s, you have the massive underrepresentation of non-white populations in popular television. And Soul Train is the beginning.
You've been listening to the University of Virginia Department of Media Studies Professor Andrea Press and UVA Department of Sociology Professor Fiona Greenland talking about the cultural significance of 50th anniversaries. On this, our season finale, we're taking a look back at three of our shows from 2021. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. Stream us live online at 979WREN.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. After the break, University of Virginia Assistant Dean and Assistant Professor Shipla Dave talks about the role that the Muppets have played in reflecting modern culture. Please stay with us. In June, Rick Moore talked with University of Virginia Assistant Dean and Assistant Professor Shipla Dave about the role that the Muppets have played in reflecting modern culture, including Disney's decision to place a content advisory on 18 episodes. Again, Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call host Rick Moore.
Our guest today, Professor Shipla Dave. She's an Associate Dean at UVA's College of Arts and Sciences, and a professor at Media Studies and American Studies. Professor Dave researches and teaches on topics including representations of race and gender in media, pop culture, American cultural narratives and immigration and border crossings, film, television, and literary studies. She's the author of many works, including Indian Accents, Brown Voice, and Racial Performance in American Television and Film, as well as Apu's Brown Voice, Cultural Inflection, and South Asian Accents. She earned her bachelor's degree at the University of Wisconsin, master's and doctorate from the University of Michigan. And today we're going to talk about learning from the Muppets. Professor, thanks for being here.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here and to be talking about the Muppets.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. Who doesn't want to talk about the Muppets?
I think that's one of the reasons why the topic is so popular, is because we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Muppets, and they're an intergenerational popular culture phenom. I mean, who hasn't heard of the Muppets? Not only are they a global sensation, but they're a national sensation. In fact, the show, one of the reasons why the show was so successful is because it was an intergenerational show. It wasn't just designed to appeal to children. It was also designed to appeal to adults. And so between the intergenerational kinds of commentary that the show made, plus the crossover media from television to film to animation to a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds and ages, too, as well.
So can you tell me, the Muppets, did they... Now, we're going back 50 years, and so certainly... sort of before my time of paying attention, did the Muppets start on Sesame Street? I realize they were created as handheld puppets of some form, but was Sesame Street the first place that they were seen and became national in some sense? And today we're going to talk about The Muppet Show, which is where they went on one of the more standard three brand TV channels. So did they start on Sesame Street?
Actually, no, they didn't. When Jim Henson was developing the Muppets, he developed Muppets Incorporated in 1959, and Sesame Street didn't premiere until 1969. So initially, when he was starting to work through with, with puppets, he was a young man, and he always wanted to work in television. And so, when he was interning as a student, he started to work with puppets. Now, Jim Henson, he never played with puppets, or he never even really saw a puppet show. What he was influenced by was radio, and in particularly the radio shows of Edward Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. And so what he decided to do was to work on that form of comedy. And so he went to University of Maryland, and he started collaborating with a woman named Jane Neville, who was working with art and education. And so he took his Muppets and then worked with her to develop this idea of the Muppets as an ensemble. And so Kermit came about, I guess, around 1955, and was known for the ping pong ball eyes. And everyone watched the Muppets in D.C., so it was actually sort of a local show in Washington, D.C., and they were oftentimes Muppets were the guests on late night and variety shows, but they didn't have their own show, and where he started making money was actually through commercials. So there was this famous coffee company called the Wilkins Coffee Branch, and the Muppets started advertising for Wilkins Coffee, and it was a huge sensation in Washington, D.C. And after that, he incorporated the Muppets, and before he graduated from college, he was the CEO of Muppets Incorporated. And that is sort of how he came to the national scene, was through commercials. And then in 1960, he actually met Frank Oz. And many people talk about the collaboration between Jim Henson and Frank Oz, many of who know him as the voice of Yoda, but who he joined sort of the company of Muppets, and the rest was history. Now, Sesame Street came about in 1969, and that was a show that was particularly funded for educational purposes. So the idea behind Sesame Street was to work towards educational programming and children's programming, and particularly to breach the gap between nursery schools and preschools and going to kindergarten and elementary school. And a lot of the mission behind Sesame Street was about social responsibility and interracial harmony. And the emphasis was on looking at the relationship between the people and the Muppets. And that's the key area there, is that was educational, and it was also geared towards a children's audience.
We are talking about the Muppets today with Professor Shilpa Dave today from University of Virginia. Professor, so a lot of the hour is going to be spent talking about the Muppet Show. Can you remind us about the Muppet Show?
Yes, so the Muppet Show, which is different from Sesame Street, which was geared towards educational programming and children's programming, while the Muppet Show was really geared towards more of an adult or intergenerational audience. Instead of being on public television, it was on network television. It was, depending upon when you watched it, usually on a Saturday or Sunday evening. And it was really trying to get families to watch it together. And it was more based, I would say, on a situation comedy kind of format, but it was set in a vaudeville theater. So the beauty of the Muppet Show was that it was genre-breaking. And what I mean by that is that it took different kinds of television narratives that we had grown accustomed to seeing over the 50s and 60s and 70s, such as comedy shows, such as variety shows, such as late night shows, and even news shows, and it lampooned all of those with a cast of Muppets in which you usually had one or maybe two human guest stars, but the ensemble cast was the Muppets. And the key element about the show was that it really showed the behind-the-scenes kind of events that were happening, as well as producing a show. And so what we got to see was an interior look at what happens behind the scenes, and at all times we, as the audience, were seeing a show, but looking behind the scenes, too, as well.
Was this the first time that the Muppets had regularly been on one of the three major networks?
Yes, it was their own headlining show. So before they had been guest stars, but what we started to see was Kermit the Frog was probably the most recognizable when the show started, and then you started to see other characters come to light. And nowadays we have in celebrity culture, people know about Miss Piggy, and they know about Kermit or Gonzo or Rolf. But initially, it was Kermit who was seen as sort of the behind-the-scenes manager. And then we were slowly introduced to different kinds of characters, such as Fozzie Bear, and such as, you know, the Electric Light Orchestra, which as ELO, actually it wasn't called, that was called Electric Mayhem, which is a spoof on the rock bands, and other kinds of individuals. And then they would bring on guest stars from all different kinds of shows, but premium guest stars, everyone from Harry Belafonte to Julie Andrews to Peter Sellers to John Denver. And so I think that's always the interesting part about it, is that it really did do the variety show, but it also brought in different people from different elements of popular culture, too, as well.
What time frame are we talking about here? We're talking about the 70s, correct?
Yeah, the late 70s. So I think what we're looking at is, this is, when we're thinking about sitcoms and we're also thinking about satire, social satire as we know it, like with The Simpsons, hadn't happened yet. What had started was Saturday Night Live, which started just about a year previous to that. And so we started to see social and cultural satire come up in late night, but we hadn't seen it in little pre-prime time, is what I would call it. And this was a way in which the Muppets could be seen as puppets, could be seen as appealing to a younger audience, but as I mentioned before, it was also appealing to adults because the genres they were playing with were different kinds of television shows that we had grown up with. One of my favorites was Pigs in Space, because you would watch it, and it was really looking, and this was before Star Wars, and then after Star Wars, they actually brought in C-3PO and R2-D2 and Mark Hamill as guest stars, but Pigs in Space was about different kinds of space shows, so they lampooned Star Trek and Lost in Space, and as I said, later on, then it sort of preceded the Star Wars phenomenon. And that was the fun of it. It became a joy to watch because of trying to figure out, what it lampooned for the adults, and for the children, just laughing at a lot of the slapstick kind of comedy that was very evident on the show.
So you talk about the Muppets being streamed, you mentioned earlier. So they've just been added, or earlier in the year, a few months ago, the Muppets have been added to Disney Plus. And one of the things that brought news out was that Disney Plus put in content warning at the beginning of 18 episodes, I believe. And I'm going to read the content warning. This program includes negative depictions and/or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now. Rather than remove this content, we want to acknowledge its harmful impact, learn from it, and spark conversation to create a more inclusive future together. Can you talk about what sort of material generates content warning from Disney Plus in regards to The Muppet Show?
Rick, I'm really glad that you asked this question. I think with The Muppets and with any kind of series that are older, as we think about media history, that we often have to think about the context and of when the show aired and what was happening then and what was happening now. And in order to be a good consumer of popular culture and also a good consumer sort of media history, you have to understand what the show was trying to accomplish and also why things might be outdated. And I think with the content warning, what Disney is trying to do is to say, we don't want to eliminate these programs because we think that they are important, part of media history. But we do want you to be aware that there might be certain kinds of stereotypes that we don't agree with anymore. And we want to alert you to that. I would hope they would go even further and help let people know about what kinds of stereotypes were happening rather than just sort of putting that warning out. And I think that's the next step that the corporations could go in. But what they were really looking at, and the shows that I've watched and then rewatched, was a lot about the ways in which different kinds of groups were caricatured, and that there were different kinds of racist depictions, oftentimes of different kinds of ethnic and racial groups, both in and out of the United States. And the idea that depicting ethnic caricature no longer applies is very, very important, because at the time, especially, when you would see a caricature of a particular group, like Latinos or Asians or other groups, people would laugh at it and think it was a kind of comedy because it was not seen as what was normalized. But what was not understood was the fact that this was sometimes the only way that anybody was introduced to difference, to people from different backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, different national backgrounds, different racial backgrounds. And so if that was the only kind of image that people were seeing, they tended to take that image and apply it to everybody who they thought looked or sounded like the person that they heard on television. And so a lot of these episodes are really asking you to relook at what the caricature might have been.
That was our June interview with University of Virginia Assistant Dean and Assistant Professor Shipla Dave about the role that the Muppets have played in reflecting modern culture. And that's it for this week and this season. We'd like to send a thank you to the many guests who took time out of their busy schedules to appear on our show this year, and for our many faithful listeners who have stayed with us for over 20 years. We'd also like to give special thanks to the good people here at 97.9 The Wren for providing this space for us. And we'll close with a reminder that this and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when host Rick Moore returns with another interesting guest. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. And just before we go, we lost a friend here at WREN. John Taylor Black passed away unexpectedly earlier this month. He was just 36 years old. John, who went by Taylor, was the kind of guy that no matter what you asked, he'd do his best to help out. Taylor was good at everything he put his hand to, and he put his hand to a lot of things. Radio, music, computers, photography, and do-it-yourself projects, among others. Perhaps you enjoyed his Sunday morning program on our sister station, WXRK. He was a thorough and conscientious volunteer who gave countless hours to community radio. He always gave it his best. Taylor was a personal friend and a colleague. Rest in peace, my friend. You will be missed.